Good evening, this is the Lesbian Radio Show. I'm Rose Jordan. Tonight I have as my guest Merlin Stone, author of When God Was a Woman. She has a master's degree in sculpture and art history and taught those subjects at the University of California at Berkeley Extension and the State University of New York at Buffalo. Also Grace Chanel, who has written numerous articles on the subject of the goddess cultures. As a matter of fact, that's what we're going to discuss, the goddess culture and feminist spirituality. This is Rose Jordan again. With me are Merlin Stone, author of When God Was a Woman, and Grace Chanel, well-known writer, whose article, Woman's Primacy in the Coming Reformation, appears in a magazine called Heresies, which is a feminist publication on art and politics. That particular issue was devoted to the great goddess. So, here we are, Merlin and Grace, and how are you this evening?
Oh, it's wonderful to be here. My favorite radio program.
Oh, is it?
It really is.
You know, I was reading through When God Was a Woman, and something in the introduction caught my eye. I'd like to, if you bear with me for a minute, quote it. You say here, in the difficulties I encountered gathering material, I could not help thinking of the ancient writing and statuary that must have been intentionally destroyed. Accounts of the antagonistic attitudes of Judaism, Christianity, and Mohammedism, that is Islam, toward the sacred artifacts of the religions that preceded them reveal that this was so, especially in the case of the goddess worshipped in Canaan, which was Palestine, is now Palestine. The bloody massacres, the demolition of statues, that is, pagan idols, and sanctuaries are recorded in the pages of the Bible following this command by Yahweh. Quote, "You must completely destroy all the places where the nations you dispossess have served their gods. On high mountains, on hills, under any spreading tree, you must tear down their altars, smash their pillars, cut down their sacred poles, set fire to the carved images of their gods, and wipe out their name from that place." Then you go on to say, there can be little doubt that the continuous attacks, as recorded in the Old Testament, destroyed much precious and irretrievable information. Well, apparently, Marilyn, they didn't destroy everything, because according to your book, an awful lot has been uncovered.
Right, they certainly didn't. This is what they've been finding in the excavations for the last 150 years. I was talking specifically about Canaan in that passage, and I went on to say they missed many, many artifacts that have been dug up, to the point where we found out that these so-called pagan gods, most of them seem to have breasts. In fact, nearly all of them in earlier periods. Mm-hmm. And when we deal with areas such as Egypt and Turkey, Iraq, Iran, Crete, Cyprus, Malta, and so on, and you know many other areas around the Mediterranean, the Near East, there's an incredible amount of evidence and information about the ancient goddess religion.
Is that popular information, or is it hidden away somewhere?
This is exactly why I wrote the book, because so many people, even people with masters and doctorates from universities, are not aware of these periods, of the Natufians, of the Halafians, Hassunans, I mean the names that we just don't hear.
Yes.
Even the Sumerians, which are becoming more popular now. But these are periods where goddess worship was extremely prevalent, and yet we know very little not only about the goddess worship in those periods, but strangely enough, very little about those periods.
I was just wondering, you said that the people in the universities, the students are you talking about?
I'm talking about the students and even many of the teachers.
Yeah, you're saying they were not aware. I'm just wondering, is it that they were not aware or are they programmed not to recognize certain things? I mean, you have, let me, there's a reason for my asking you that question. There's another thing here that you wrote in the introduction, and it's a, let's see, a J. Maringer, professor of prehistoric archaeology, rejected the idea that reindeer skulls were the hunting trophies of a Paleolithic tribe. And says the reason, they were found in the grave of a woman. And he writes, here the skeleton was that of a woman, a circumstance that would seem to rule out the possibility that reindeer skulls and antlers were hunting trophies. So you go on to say, might these authors be judging the inherent physical nature of women by the fragile, willowy ideals of today's Western fashions? Well, I just think that they've just have preconceived ideas.
Right. Well, the point is that anyone that's a professor today or even 50 years ago was at one time a student. And these things just go round and round in the so-called academic circles until the entire student body accepts what's being said. But these are the very people who do become professors and teachers, and they just continue the distortion and the inaccuracies.
May I say something?
Sure, Grace.
Isn't it very likely that there was a political purpose and that this is not anything that this obfuscation that we're constantly encountering whenever we try to do any research, isn't it likely that there was a deliberate effort to obscure our heritage and that it might have been politically based?
I don't know how conscious it was. It feels like a conspiracy when you start finding this enormous amount of information and realizing that so little is brought out in general education. But I guess we have to take into account the fact that, first of all, most of the scholars are male, so that if they find information that shows that the female was the supreme deity, this is something that they find uncomfortable to deal with and generally pop over it very quickly. Also, if they find information that the status of women economically or in the clergy or in any way was supreme or very, very high, they also chop that up or, you know, go over it very, very quickly. So the fact that most of the scholars were male plays a tremendous, you know, part. Also the fact that most of them were raised in the Judeo-Christian tradition, so that all of these religions were the so-called pagan religions and really shouldn't be discussed except as they relate to the, you know, current Judeo-Christian tradition.
I remember something from the Bible, because I was brought up a Catholic, and there was this, I guess it was an incident, but I recently I realized it's probably larger than just one incident, where it was what Moses told the populace to not to worship craven idols, and it was the bull. Is that the...
The calf, right, the graven
calf,
images, right.
Wasn't that the Gynocracy's, the woman worshipping?
It was a symbol of the Hathor heifer, the Hathor cow.
So would you say offhand that this was not quite an incident, but it was just a story about
patriarchal
revolt?
Laced, yeah, the Bible is laced with information about the ancient religion, but they never describe it as such. It's always sort of tucked in.
Yes.
I mean, when we read that Solomon worshipped Ashtoreth, we don't even hear that she's female. She's just a pagan abomination. And this is the kind of thing that we constantly deal with, and why it's so important to finally reclaim this information and to connect it.
Well, Grace, you said something about a political thing. Why do you think they always referred to the female god as an abomination and called it pagan rites? I mean, what is the abomination all about?
Well, I think the reason why this has enormous political importance, and that is the reason why we as women today must be interested in these ancient times, is because if you demonstrate that women founded civilization and had a wide-reaching role that extended beyond simply child reproduction, you are proving that there is another pattern that women today can follow. And it also is a racial question. Archaeology was essentially started by the British at a time when their dominion extended over these very regions that Merlin has enumerated.
Mm-hmm.
All of that was part of the British Empire. And as we all know, white Western man was bringing Christendom to the heathen, and he was bringing civilization to the very areas that had had civilization millennia before white Western
man. You mean
man.
He was replacing civilization with his own type of civilization?
What he called civilization, and he did not want any demonstration of a more ancient civilization, especially one that was gynocentric and one that was perhaps dominated by people of color, as you might have had in Egypt and Libya, and then, of course, the Kanagi people, the Phoenician people, are red-skinned people.
Mm-hmm.
So this has many ramifications, and that's why it's very political today.
You mentioned earlier to me something about... I was wondering, a lot of women are talking now about matriarchy. Okay. Now, can we define that word so that we could either get it out of the way or use a different word or do something with it so that we know what we're talking about?
Mm-hmm.
I always felt that I feel that patriarchy is a distortion of either gynocratic cultures, goddess cultures, matriarchal cultures. I don't think patriarchy is anything real. I think it's something that's been stolen and reshaped in some way. Is that pretty accurate, or is there a better way of saying that?
Well, first of all, it's probably worthwhile defining the various terms that, you know, get tossed about. Matriarchy literally means rule by women, and we use this almost as a mirror image of the concept of patriarchy. Matrifocal means where the woman has a great amount of power, where she stays in her home, where if she has a male mate, he comes and stays in her home, she owns the property, and so on. Then we have matrilocal, which is somewhat similar, but she has a little bit less power. Then matrilineal, where she has basically the ownership of the land and ownership of the property. The children take her name rather than the father's name, but she doesn't have quite the power, and yet still has enough power, just having her own, you know, place to live, and the fact that the children are hers. And so each of these terms says a certain amount, but all infer a very different kind of society than we think of today in a patrilineal or patriarchal society. But all of them also use the word matri, which is mother. And we find in many of the ancient accounts and the ancient law codes that one need not have been a mother so much as simply a woman to have the higher status. And so probably the word that would best define what we're talking about would be a gynocentric or a gynofocal society, which would not necessarily imply that women were dominating men to the extent that men dominate women today, but that it was simply accepted that the mother was, or even the woman, you know, was wiser, was knowledgeable, was capable of taking care of most of the responsibilities of the community.
Well, that's fine, but I was just wondering why that would have happened, why the woman would have been the supreme person, the creator, the focal point, let's say, of the society. Was there at any time, let's say, I don't know where I'm going with this, but would there have been a time, a point in time, theoretically even, that this was done because she did create life in some way?
Well, I think her powers are to be extended beyond the mere creation of a duplication, a replica of herself. Her powers are clearly those of the psyche and wisdom as well as reproductive. And this power is something I go into in the article as a basis for women's primacy in the coming Reformation, that women have a complete circuitry out of their biochemistry, whereas men do not have a complete circuitry. They are literally short-circuited biochemically. And frequency is form. The form of the male differs because the frequency of the male differs. His ability to reach transcendent states, psychic states, is limited, and I think women were able to be sibyls and sorceresses, and these were very honored positions. I think they knew a great deal about transmutation, practiced it. They weren't tied into the material because they understood the power of the spiritual, that energy is spirit, and that is a dynamic form of energy, whereas matter is merely a static form of energy. Mm-hmm. And women, with their ability to transcend, could reach higher spiritual states. Yeah, that's why I think they were held holy.
Was this actually measurable in some, is it measurable in any way? This frequency you're talking about?
Yes, it's measurable biochemically.
Right, it sounds
to
me
there are studies
as if what you're saying, which I believe men are short-circuited, but what you're saying, they're also kind of off-balance in some way. that the focal point of their balance is not in the same place in the body? Is that also?
Well, this is true physically,
physically?
Yes. The center of gravity in a man is in his shoulders. The center of gravity in a woman is in her pelvic region, is in her cough center. And yoga requires, all of the yoga positions require that you put your center of gravity in your solar plexus.
Okay, now we go to the yogis. Now, that most of them are male.
They're
not really?
It's a very ancient goddess religion.
Yes, I agree, but would you say that in this day and age it seems as if most of them are male?
Well, we have a mostly male clergy.
That's
we see what men have done,
That's
how they have taken over.
Right. Yeah.
But their capacity to teach and their capacity to transmit is limited, whereas women have a greater capacity.
Yeah, you know, I don't know if we're digressing or not, but when you said the clergy, it is a matter of rule that the male clergy, of course, is celibate.
In some religions.
Yes, in the Catholic religion especially.
Mm.
Since to me the Catholic religion seems to embody the goddess culture in everything they seem to do, in a very distorted way. But I was just wondering, when you said about off balance and psychic and spirituality, is the celibacy supposed to center them in some way? Is that does that create a different kind of energy? Is that what you're
insinuating? So. This is an important point. Male religions, as Merlin often documents in her book, When God Was a Woman, have traditionally prescribed women's sexuality, have sought to restrict it. The ancient matriarchal or gynocentric religions did not restrict sexuality, because sexuality between women is not merely to reproduce children, as it is between men and women.
Mm-hmm.
Sexuality between women can attain a spiritual basis. The basis would seem to be unity, oneness, and there is no need to restrict that. Whereas if you're concerned about overpopulating, then you do have to restrict your sexuality.
I see. Is that why you think, to get down to 1978, that there are so many rules, regulations, laws, attitudes, taboos, whatever word you'd like to use, on lesbianism? Is it the fear of the woman sexuality becoming stronger, spirituality rather, to becoming stronger? Is that something that's keyed into this taboo?
That to me seems, I mean, this is really totally out of my field in one sense, but to me that just seems like an extension of the male intention of dominating anything that, you know, women do. I mean, feeling that anything that they can do without the male is something that they should not be doing, or that they'd rather they were not
doing. Well, yeah, but I thought it was more of an ancient fear.
There's no law.
As Grace was saying, when the purity of sexuality between two women, for instance, has a certain amount of energizing effect, I was just wondering if that was could that have keyed into the fear to stop that from going on? More than just political dominance.
We
I was just wondering.
We certainly suspect
that
it might have. And certainly if women discover that their wholeness is within themselves, that they do not need to pair with men. For instance, parthenogenesis is a reality. Virgin birth is not a myth. It is a truth.
You mean a reality now?
Yes.
Well, that threw me for a minute. Okay. I mean, I'm inclined to believe this, but... is there any proof of this, any kind of...
embryologists...
Not that we always have to have proof, but, you know, we seem to have it, but what...
Well, embryologists, and there's a quote that I've just handed you from a very prominent embryologist. If you would just read that, I think that might give a very...
What is he, C.R. Austin, is it?
Yes,
University
he is the holder of the Charles Darwin Chair of Embryology.
The vast size of the human population compels the admission that with a one-in-a-million chance, there could be a sprinkling of individuals in the community who have arisen by natural parthenogenesis. They would, of course, be female and would resemble their mothers very closely, but otherwise need not show any telltale features. Well, is this just, well, I don't know.
That is not a theory. He's compelled to admit it, as he says, reluctant as he is. And one of his colleagues, who he regularly publishes with, would take great exception to that, except that he cannot. There is every reason to believe that parthenogenesis is occurring routinely in the human race as early as 1955 as the result of a mere university lecture by Jane Spurway, because women don't get to publish very much. There was an extensive survey conducted to seek parthenogenomes, females who were born only from their mother's egg cleaving and had no father. And this survey resulted in the highly probable identification of such a female. That was the conclusion of a very reluctant scientific team led by Stanley Balfour. And aside from that quote, there is every other kind of evidence. The professor of biology from Yale University has said that there's every reason to believe that we will develop parthenogenesis in the human species.
When he says we will develop, how is that going to be done? By whom?
Well, this is the problem, because we know science is controlled by men, and research in particular. Mm-hmm. If women do get to be scientists, they are lucky to be teachers.
Yes.
And what they are doing now really constitutes a new rape of women. Their ability to clone from ova is a new rape of women, and it's being obscured. What we are being told is they are inseminating a group of cells, rather than use the word ova. Whenever we speak of cloning, we always require ova. We do not always require sperm, but you must always have the female product, the egg.
You said something to me before we went on the air about, which I don't understand too clearly, that sperm is also female. The X chromosome and the Y is in... They were trying to separate them in some way?
Yeah.
Identify them as
the word. Well, yes, there are X sperm and there are Y sperm.
Mm-hmm.
And in sexual reproduction, the sperm that reaches the egg determines the sexuality. That is, if an X sperm fertilizes the egg, you have a female.
Mm-hmm.
Because the egg is always an X sperm.
Mm-hmm.
If a Y sperm fertilizes the egg, you have an XY or... what you could call a male. Of course, mm-hmm. we might question that there are such creatures as males.
I don't agree with that word. I don't think that exists. I think, in my view, and I'm not a geneticist or anything else, I think that's a word that was invented to give this mutated female an identity, and I really don't blame them for doing that, but this is the way it is.
Yeah.
I think it's a false identity, and I think it harms men to really key into that kind of thing.
Yes, they would be better thinking of themselves as part women whose development has been arrested in the embryonic stage, mm-hmm. because, unfortunately, the ovaries were forced to produce hormones which subsequently developed the embryo, distended the vagina, put the clitoris at the end, in other words, a penis, and externalized
forced,
the ovaries.
You said forced to develop. What kind of force is used?
Well, initially what happens, and this is a determinable fact, that the Y sex chromosome has less specific gravity than the X chromosome. The result of that is that the developing gonad, which will become an ovary ordinarily, is more external on the egg and is subject to the amniotic fluids and other stimulation in the womb,
mm-hmm.
it begins producing hormones. Now, there again you have what you denoted, that men have traditionally distinguished themselves by creating words, that specify them.
Mm-hmm.
So they create the word testes. They are really talking about atrophied ovaries.
Yes.
They are really talking, when they say testosterone, of the same hormones that women have.
They really determined to be quite different.
Yeah.
I know.
Through this
very,
distortion,
very different. Yes.
By distorting. Uh-huh. And thereby, because they expend their hormones in the embryonic stage, they do not have the hormones to complete their female development. And that particularly shows at pubescence when their mammaries do not develop and they are unable to keep hair from growing in certain places.
Yes. Well, that was a very scientific presentation.
Really?
You know, I'm
sitting here wondering.
I know, I am too. I'm absolutely.
No, I was going to say, I'm sitting here wondering, coming in from the other end, since Grace's area is an area I really don't know enough about. But in the ancient religion in Turkey, the goddess Kibel's clergy was basically originally female, but slowly males began to enter the clergy, and the only way they were allowed to is when they castrated themselves and put on women's robes.
Mm-hmm.
And just sitting here listening to what Grace is saying, it's
yes.
Causing me to wonder about the reasons. You know, apparently they had something like 5,000 castrated men in one city as the clergy, which seems like an awful lot of clergy.
Yes,
but,
it would.
Awful
lot of men in one city, too.
Yeah. it's a big city.
We keep mentioning the clergy over and over again, and I was just wondering, you know, it just struck in my mind that the idea of the Trinity, you know, the Father, the Son, the Holy Ghost,
mm.
I always felt that a Trinity had to do with some kind of, not procreation, but yes, procreation of connections in some way, different dimensions of the same. And I don't know how men could procreate with themselves. You know, really. Wasn't there something about, who was it, Grace or you, was talking about tribidism?
Grace is speaking about that?
Yeah, let's get into that a little.
Tribidism.
That was that's what does that mean exactly?
Well, there is now a publication called Tribid, and it's published by a group called Fort Dyke on Prince Street.
Mm-hmm.
And they have pointed out this word as originating from the Greek tribian to rub, and it is in all dictionaries a word that is defined simply and solely as lesbianism.
Mm-hmm.
That's fascinating because the Greek root is tri and then B-A-O. That means three-based, and the same root, three-based, exists for the word tribe. That means that lesbians were the tribe. That women were the original trinity, the original family unit, was, as it's always depicted in ancient remains, was the grandmother, sometimes called the crone, the goddess Hecate,
mm-hmm.
or and then her daughter, the mother, and then her daughter, the third generation, who is confused as a virgin, but you have to understand the implications of virgin in that sense.
Well, that must mean just innocence or newness, or I'm sure it doesn't mean what men say.
Merlin has some fascinating information
about
Artemis.
Oh, if you...
Connection, yes.
Yeah, here I am with my papers all over the place.
Oh, well...
Artemis was traditionally a virgin goddess.
Yes.
She is part of this trinity.
Right. No, what I brought was a section from the book I'm working now,
right.
Which is legends of goddesses from all over the world, from Mexico and Ireland.
I'll tell you what, right now I'd like to take a break because we are going to take phone calls, okay? We'll take a little musical break, and when we get, let me get the phone number. It's 212-279-3407. Now, when we come back, we're going to read from that.
Yeah.